The church board was meeting, and the board members needed to decide whether to commit the church to a multi-million dollar building program. Someone on the board said they shouldn't make a decision on this until there had been a time of prayer and fasting. Some said they should take a survey of the congregation first to see how much money people might give. A lone voice said the board should just trust God and move forward. What would you have said? It's a completely fictitious board, by the way. A minister was trying to work out whether he should go to a conference. It was to be held overseas, and there would be considerable costs. One advisor told him to trust God for the money and register for the conference. But another voice inside him told him to weigh carefully the financial cost, the cost to his ministry responsibilities, and the cost to his family. How would you have advised him? The best approach is not always clear, is it? When you have to make plans and decisions, there are often many possibilities. Even as Christians, there may be more than one way forward, one right way, one best way. If you think about it at a personal level, how would you answer these questions? Should I expand my business? Should we move house or renovate? Where should we send our children to school? All of us want our plans to succeed rather than fail. Is success more guaranteed if we pray more, if we do more research, if we trust God more? Hard to answer, isn't it? Nehemiah knows this tension. He's cupbearer to the king Artaxerxes, the king of Persia. It's the 5th century before Christ. And God has put in Nehemiah's heart a plan to leave his job and to go to Jerusalem and rebuild its ruined walls. But there are things that must be planned and organized before you set out to do something as grand as that. Not least, he needs to get permission from his boss. He needs time off. Let's see what he does and see if we can learn anything from chapter 2 of this Old Testament book. So verses 1 to 9. Nehemiah is a servant who honours the gracious hand of God. Chapter 2 begins 4 months after chapter 1, which we looked at last week. We know that from looking at the months mentioned in chapter 1, verse 1, and chapter 2, verse 1. What has Nehemiah been doing for these 4 months, I wonder? Well, he's definitely been working in his secular job, serving the king, ensuring the king's safety, advising him when required, and looking happy in the king's presence, because you weren't supposed to bring all your problems into the king. I suspect over these 4 months he was also praying. He kept on praying using the type of prayer language that we saw in chapter 1, where we get a very strong sense of God's character, that Nehemiah knew that God is the God of heaven, the God who gives success in human affairs. I suspect he kept praying for those months. And I suspect he was planning, he was thinking and considering. After all, he knows his boss, King Artaxerxes, stopped the rebuilding of Jerusalem 20 years earlier. So he needs to think carefully, how am I going to change this man's mind? So I believe over these months he's working and praying and planning. And perhaps that's a good model for decision-making, to integrate those three into our process of making decisions. Let's have a look a little bit more closely at the text. In verses 1 and 2, he appears in the king's presence doing his job, bringing wine. Now remember, Nehemiah's life is in the king's hand. One false move, one impertinent comment or question out of place, and the king could take his life, at least could chuck him in jail, at a moment's notice. The king notices something unusual. Nehemiah is sad. This is against protocol, and Nehemiah has never been like this before. Now, an interesting question. Has Nehemiah been caught out? The king has seen something that Nehemiah didn't mean him to see. Or, in his praying and planning, has Nehemiah come to the conclusion this might be the safest way to open up this delicate conversation? It's hard to know. The text doesn't tell us. But when the king asks, "Why do you look so sad?" the moment has come. John White, in his little paperback on Nehemiah, says this moment is like when the hang glider steps off the mountain and wonders if the air will hold him up. The king's question, even if asked out of pastoral care, carries with it a threat. And Nehemiah knows that he is in a threatening situation. So what should he do? How should he respond? He is very much afraid, it says, and quite right. He knows this moment is dangerous. Now, isn't that how it is sometimes when you're trying to make decisions? That you know God is there, you know God is in charge, that he is sovereign, but we also know fear. Yes, God is the God who works for good for those who love him, as Paul says in Romans. But we don't always know how God will do that at any particular moment, do we? As Don Carson says, there is an enigmatic dimension to God's providence. So Nehemiah is afraid, and still he knows who God is. The two are not mutually exclusive. But what he does is instructive. Despite his fear, he remains a man of faith and he speaks. Again, modelling for us a way forward, not to let fear stop us doing what God has called us to do. Now, under questioning from the king, Nehemiah will say, I think, things that he has thought about over those months of prayer, things that he's carefully considered. Verse 3, he responds, "Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates destroyed?" Note there is no direct mention of Jerusalem. Why get your boss offside right at the start? He points to family honour and respect for the dead, something a Persian king would appreciate. He's very careful in what he says and what he doesn't say. The king, verse 4, then says, "What do you want?" So Nehemiah has survived the opening gambit, and now he must put something concrete on the table. Before he answers, he says a short, silent prayer. Some people call this an arrow or bullet prayer. This short prayer in the heat of battle must be seen in the context of these months of prayer that have gone before. He's a deeply prayerful person, and he's been praying and fasting, and he just needs an extra little prayer right at that moment. He says one last prayer before speaking. So you see how intercessory prayer can happen before and during decision-making processes. Sometimes at committee meetings, you might start the meeting with a prayer and never pray again through the meeting. But you can stop and pray. Sometimes at a small group, you might pray at the beginning or pray at the end, but you can pray in between. Nehemiah is showing us that he prays right in the midst of what he's doing. He answers, verse 5, "If it pleases the king, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried so that I can rebuild it." Still no direct mention of Jerusalem, just a nice way of sort of alluding to that city in Judah. But now he adds the critical information. He wants to rebuild the city. But the way he phrases it, he invites the king to be in charge of the project. "If it pleases the king, let, you know, you send me, you delegate to me." Nehemiah knows how to talk to people who have incredible power. Verse 6 shows that the king is happy to send him, and he wants to know simply how long the project will take. At that point, Nehemiah is past the worst of it. His prayer has been answered, he's been given time off, and the king is showing signs that he will back the project. So the Jerusalem project is on the way. Verses 7 to 9 show how Nehemiah has been thinking and planning, because now you see him sort out all sorts of practical things with the king. Letters of safe conduct, wood for building that the king will pay for, and even a small army of imperial forces to protect him. So Nehemiah comes out of this fear-inducing, knee-knocking, frightening situation with, get this, permission to build, written authority, time off work, and the financial and military backing of the Persian Empire. That's not a bad result for 4 months of prayer and fasting, is it? And I suspect Nehemiah could walk away feeling pretty pleased with himself. But let's note his theological interpretation of what has just happened. Verse 8b. This is how he understands things. Because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my requests. Nehemiah is not so self-centered or arrogant as to think he has achieved it all. He has rightly acknowledged that God grants success. Now, it's a helpful reminder to us, I think, to be humble about our successes. He acknowledges his good outcome is God's doing. It's the providence of God. So when you get cooperation from your employer, when your plans go well, when you get everything you need and even more, it's appropriate to stop and thank God. So what does Nehemiah do that would help us to make decisions? Let me summarize. He prays and fasts. The outcome, I think, of the prayer and fasting is he becomes more deeply certain himself of what God wants him to do. And you too will need this prayerful certainty at times in your life, particularly when you're facing big decisions. The prayer in chapter 1 shows that Nehemiah is deeply aware of the character of God. And you too need to be sure of this. You need to be absolutely sure of God's sovereignty and his goodness and his love that he's poured out on you in the person of Jesus. This will give you that inner confidence to move forward. Secondly, Nehemiah thinks and plans. And I think it's wise to take time to consider what we need and not just rush in. I think sometimes prayer and planning can be polarized too much, and it's good to try and do both. Thirdly, he acts and speaks courageously. At times, we need to face our fears. They could be fears of the unknown. They could be fears that you're going to speak to someone who holds your life or your work or something important in their prerogative, in their hands, and you need to convince them of something. But so we need to just face those fears, trust God that he's with us, keep praying, because nothing will be achieved if it just stays internal. At some stage or another, you've got to put things out there for other people to see if you're wanting to try and achieve anything. Prayer, planning, and then action. Key ingredients to decision-making and moving forward. Now, just before we move on, I want to ask another question about discerning what is the right approach when it comes to making a decision. Before Nehemiah returned to Jerusalem, some other exiles returned under the leadership of a person called Ezra. And you'll see the book in the Bible prior to Nehemiah is called Ezra. Ezra was a priest and a teacher of the law, more a sort of religious leader. Now, when Ezra was offered soldiers to escort him back, to protect him going back with these earlier exiles, Ezra refused. He said, "No, I don't want any soldiers because God will protect us." In chapter 8 of Ezra, verses 22 and 23, you can read about it. He said, "I was ashamed to ask the king for soldiers to protect us." He trusted God, not soldiers. Something admirable about that, isn't there? Something heroic almost. And yet a little while after Ezra, Nehemiah accepts a military escort. In fact, he takes everything he can get from the king. Which one is right? Yes to soldiers, no to soldiers. It's an interesting question, isn't it? And I think we must look at the motivation of each of these leaders. You see, they're both motivated by the same thing, the glory of God. That's what is at the root of why they act the way they act. Both want to see God honoured, but they act differently in trying to achieve that. In Ezra's case, he was first one back, and he had a vision about God, and he wanted everyone to know that God was bringing these exiles back. He didn't want that compromised at all. So he wanted all the glory to go to God, obviously. He wanted it to be so obvious, and that's why he said no to soldiers. By the time of Nehemiah, though, there has been an imperial prohibition on rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. And Nehemiah needed to have the imperial precedent reversed. Otherwise, it could look like when he arrives, he's simply leading a rebellion, which is what some of the opponents suggest at the end of chapter 2. So he says yes to soldiers. The soldiers show that the king is behind this project, that the imperial prohibition has been removed. And that will be important to winning the people's support and overcoming the local opponents. Now that's wisdom, isn't it? I think it's the same motivation. They're both motivated by the glory of God and the restoration of God's people, but they act differently to achieve those godly purposes. Now, I think it's great wisdom to act differently to a godly precedent. Nehemiah had set a godly precedent. Sorry, Ezra had set a godly precedent. Nehemiah needed wisdom to act differently. How many churches and how many ministries keep doing the same things the same way because God honored a particular method in a previous time? You need godly wisdom to know when to make a different decision, to change things. You too might find this. Sometimes you think God works this way in my life, and you're not open to the fact that God might surprise you and be working a different way. That's why you need to be constantly in prayer, listening for how God's Spirit might be moving and changing. Nehemiah is a servant who honours the gracious hand of God, and he's a servant who works wisely and knows that God gives success. Second half of the chapter, much more briefly. Verses 10 to 20. Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem and immediately meets opposition in the